From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents A Conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for the first Sunday in December 2015. This, of course, is our weekly look at the politics of the last week and what may lie ahead in the days to come. So grab that Sunday paper, that hot cup of coffee, and we'll try to get your week off to an interesting start. And you know, Dave, I know this is normally the time that you and I have a bit of lighthearted kibitzing, but with the incidents of the past few weeks, particularly the Laquan McDonald shooting video and charges of murder filed against police officer Jason Van Dyke, the firing of police superintendent Gary McCarthy, it's just been kind of nonstop news.
Not to mention San Bernardino.
That's correct.
Yes.
And, well, you know, we've got so much going on here in the city of Chicago that I just want to move right ahead. And I want to start with a clip of Mayor Rahm Emanuel speaking at a Politico breakfast last week, saying how he's not going to resign.
You know, we have a process. It's called the election. The voters spoke. I'll be held accountable and responsible for my actions and the decisions I make, and that's how I approach it. I never shrink from the responsibility of making what I think are the very tough decisions to move the city forward. People can express their views, but as it relates to what I have to do, the people had to vote, they made a decision, and I'm going to execute the responsibilities with being the mayor and be accountable for the decisions I make and be responsible for making those decisions.
So we have calls for resignation of Rahm Emanuel and Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez, calls for a federal Justice Department probe of Chicago police practices, and I think what we have here is a city with a crisis in confidence. Emanuel first rejected a Department of Justice probe, then quickly backpedaled after Hillary Clinton called for it. Emanuel didn't help himself when he maintained he didn't understand the question about whether the Department of Justice should come in. And now we have Emanuel's attempts to explain himself in both of Chicago's Sunday newspapers. He has an op-ed in which he says Chicago is facing a defining moment on the issues of crime and policing and the even larger issues of truth and justice. Quoting the mayor, "What happened last October 2014 on South Pulaski Road should never have happened. Systems should have been in place to prevent it. Supervision and leadership at every level of the police department and the oversight agencies should have come into play. They didn't, and that has to change." But the mayor adds, "What I strongly reject is the suggestion that the videotape of the McDonald shooting was withheld from the public because of the election." He goes on to state his basis for withholding the video and goes on to say, quote, "At the end of the day, I am the mayor and I own it. I take responsibility for what happened and I will fix it. Nothing less than complete and total reform of the system and the culture will meet the standards we have to set for ourselves. If there is any good to come out of this horrific incident, it has caused us to reexamine how we handle cases of police misconduct and excessive force in Chicago, and I'm committed to making the changes our city desperately needs." Well, you know, here's another problem is, and you'll see this in your Sunday newspapers as well, how the various police interviews after the shooting don't necessarily match up to that video. And let me quote from one of these. This is one of the reports. Quote, "McDonald raised the knife across his chest and over his shoulder, pointing the knife at Van Dyke, the officer. Van Dyke believed McDonald was attacking Van Dyke with the knife and attempting to kill Van Dyke. In defense of his life, Van Dyke backpedaled and fired his handgun at McDonald to stop the attack. Van Dyke continued to fire his weapon at McDonald as McDonald was on the ground, as McDonald appeared to be attempting to get up, all the while continuing to point the knife at Van Dyke." Dave, I don't know about you. We've seen that video.
Yes. Many, many times now.
Van Dyke, the officer charged with murder in the shooting, was not backpedaling. In fact, he was moving forward. Laquan McDonald was on the ground. There was no movement attempt to try to get up, as this report would suggest. It's completely counter to everything that was seen in that video. And remember what I said about a crisis in confidence in this city? I don't know about you, Dave, but I think that's where we're at right now. I've never seen this city this way before.
No, and I was thinking about that myself, you know, having memories all the way back to Richard J. Daley and the era in the 1960s, you know, not to mention, you know, not only the 1968 Democratic Convention, but all of the incidents surrounding the assassination of Martin Luther King and then Robert Kennedy. But this is, I think, perhaps without precedent, yeah.
And frankly, I think it also shows a weakness in this mayor that is not something that he necessarily portrays. Now, note in this op-ed, he does not say that he made a mistake. But certainly you are seeing this mayor in a way that no one's ever seen Rahm Emanuel before.
We are also going to be interesting to see once the any and all federal investigations take place here, you know, what that might reveal.
Right, and the U.S. Department of Justice says that it's reviewing these calls, which have come from Hillary Clinton, from Bernie Sanders, you know, they're all over the
city. On the national stage.
Yeah, yes, and I was actually talking to a friend of mine yesterday who had just gotten back from Washington, D.C., and everybody knows he's from Chicago, and they kept asking him, what the heck is going on in Chicago?
Yeah, these are the questions that you get, and I've had inquiries from out-of-town friends. You know, I mentioned it last week, the week before, a couple people asking me if I was safe, you know, in light of what they see on network television for them. One person being in the D.C. area, the other person being on the West Coast. But they're asking about my own safety as friends. And, yeah, it gets back to that basic question. What is going on in Chicago?
Right. And as I say, it's a crisis of confidence for people that live here in the city, and it's a crisis of confidence in this city by people who live outside it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news and traffic. Producer Jasmine will be fielding your phone calls, and you can reach us at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at that number, 312-981-7200. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin, all one word, and also on Twitter @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is manning the board to keep us up and going on the air here. And remember, if you miss any of this show or want to listen to our past shows, you can keep up with us on our podcasts. And you can find those at WGNRadio.com, or you can also go to iTunes and search for Rick Pearson. Coming up, we've got a great show today. We've got, after 7:30 news, we'll talk to State Representative Ron Sandeck of Downers Grove, and he's the House GOP floor leader, and we'll talk about whether there's any progress being made in Springfield. After Dave's 8 o'clock newscast, we'll be talking to Amanda Lewis. She's an associate professor at the University of Illinois Chicago, and she's been doing some research into the issue of the racial achievement gap in schools. And then after the 8:30 news, Richard Dye, Dick Dye from the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs, Dick will be joining the show to talk about Illinois' bad budgeting practices. That's all coming up, but first we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Dashing through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh, o'er the fields we go, laughing all the way. Bells on bobtail ring, making spirits bright. What fun it is to ride and sing a sleighing song tonight. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Oh, jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh.
I figured it's time to kind of bring out the Christmas music a little bit. That's the University of Illinois Ripcord's a cappella group, when it was led by my daughter, Amanda, our unofficial music director here. So we'll be interspersing some of those cuts today. It's time for our weekly spin through national politics. And, you know, once again, President Obama was forced to talk about another outbreak of gun violence, the shootings in San Bernardino, California, amid evidence that this couple had become radicalized.
We're going to get to the bottom of this, and that we are going to be vigilant, as we always are, in getting the facts before we issue any decisive judgments in terms of how this occurred. More broadly, as I said yesterday, we see the prevalence of these kinds of mass shootings in this country. And I think so many Americans sometimes feel as if there's nothing we can do about it. We are fortunate to have an extraordinary combination of law enforcement and intelligence and military that work every single day to keep us safe. But we can't just leave it to our professionals to deal with the problem of these kinds of horrible killings.
Now, of course, the president will be speaking to the nation from the Oval Office tonight at 7 o'clock, talking about the ongoing investigation in San Bernardino. And also he's supposed to talk about, according to the White House, the broader threat of terrorism, and will reiterate his firm conviction that ISIL or ISIS will be destroyed. Now, Republican candidates for the White House have been continuing to use the issue of radical Islamic terrorism to attack Obama and his policies on ISIS in the Middle East. Here's Florida Senator Marco Rubio.
The threats facing our country and Israel have grown dramatically in recent months, in large part because our president has placed his own legacy ahead of our mutual security. But of course, when we gather here a year from now, we will have a new president-elect. And depending on, you can clap, this is a, depending on who that is, it will have either taken a significant step towards reviving American leadership in the world and in the process advancing Israel's security, or we will have slid even further towards weakness and disengagement.
Ohio Republican Governor John Kasich is trying to use a time-tested theme, saying Obama's presidency shows it's no time for on-the-job training in a dangerous world.
As an executive in a big state, over the course of the years that I've been in, I've dealt with one crisis after another. And each time you deal with one, you learn. And you get better. And you get stronger. And you calm people that are around you. That's what's so important about being an executive, because as President of the United States, every day, every single day, it's another thing that flies at you. You don't learn on the job. You got to have dealt with these things to be the most effective you can be.
Now, Florida Republican Governor Jeb Bush has taken to the airwaves with a new ad, of course, using national security as a focus. It features Medal of Honor winners touting his candidacy. The ad includes retired Marine Major General James Livingston with a little slap at Donald Trump.
This is no reality show. This is serious business. This is about the livelihood of our kids and grandkids. This Commander-in-Chief requires training wheels.
This station hungers for leadership. We need Jeb Bush.
Jeb Bush will rebuild our military and make us proud to be Americans.
Jeb Bush is ready to take the role of Commander-in-Chief.
Jeb Bush has the experience and those leadership skills. He represents the beliefs of this country. He'll have the American people's confidence, and he will be respected on the world stage.
Meanwhile, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has been bashing Trump over Trump's claim that he saw thousands of Arab Americans cheering the fall of the Twin Towers on 9/11. Christie said at first he didn't remember that happening, but now he says, don't parse my words, it didn't happen.
People microanalyze every word. I said I don't remember it, and I wanted to qualify it that day, not that I thought it happened, but just to remind people that that was a very emotional day for me. It was personally emotional, and I was not focused that day on everything that was going on all across the state. What I was focused on was my wife and my brother, who were in Lower Manhattan and who I hadn't heard from for a long, long time. So, you know, but definitively, I've said this a number of times. It didn't happen. And so, you know, I said I didn't remember it. That was the way I put it that day. It wasn't me trying to hedge anything. It was me telling you the truth. I don't remember it happening, which means, and I said, I think even that day. And if it hadn't happened, I'm pretty sure I'd remember it. So, you know, but if you'd like me to say it another way, I'm happy to say it another way. It didn't happen. And, you know, the fact is that, you know, people can say anything, but the facts are the facts. And that did not happen in New Jersey that day, and it hasn't happened since.
Republican candidates had a big gathering last week, a Republican Jewish forum. Trump was there and then, of course, found himself being accused of anti-Semitism.
Look, I'm a negotiator like you folks. We're negotiators. We don't build gas stations in the middle of, as you know, Afghanistan for $43 million. Can you imagine this? A small gas station, $43 million. And then they use the wrong kind of terminal because they don't sell that type of gas. Okay, $43 million for a gas station. How many think they could have done it for less? Would you raise your hand, please? But I look at Obama, I look at that deal where we gave to Iran $150 billion. They don't need to develop nuclear weapons. They can buy them. They can buy them. It's true. Why do they have to develop them? They can buy them. We gave them $150 billion. They go out, and in terms of, surveillance, they have the right to self-inspect. How about that? On their major, the most dangerous, they can self-inspect. We're going to let them self-inspect. And then you have, of course, the 24 days. But the 24 days, we're all good with contracts. Don't start until such and such happens. It could be forever before you ever go in to inspect.
We're all good at contracts. I'm a negotiator like you folks. That's your Donald Trump update for today. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
312-981-7200 is our phone number. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio, and this is your Sunday Spin. Wanted to play one more cut because of all of the goings on in Republican presidential politics, and out in Iowa. Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz created a bit of a controversy when he explained how, despite Democratic attacks, he didn't see a war on women.
When the war on women came up, Republicans would curl up in a ball. They'd say, "Don't hurt me." Jiminy Cricket, this is a made-up nonsense example. Last I checked, we don't have a rubber shortage in America. Look, when I was in college, we had a machine in the bathroom. You put 50 cents in and voila. So, yes, anyone who wants contraceptives can access them, but it's an utterly made-up nonsense issue.
There you go. That's the state of the political debate today. Well, we're going to talk about the state of the state right now. Joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio is State Representative Ron Sandak, Republican from Downers Grove, a Republican House floor leader. And Representative Sandak has been in the legislature since 2010. But actually, you kind of did the reverse because you started out as in the state Senate and then moved over to the House. I assume it's because everybody refers to the state Senate as the nursing home of Illinois government.
Yeah, it's something like that. It's certainly a sleepy, docile place in comparison to the People's House, which is rancorous.
Raucous, that's for sure. I wanted to have you on to talk about last week in Springfield and the fact that we did have a little bit of movement here. It was a bill that would release $3.1 billion to pay Illinois lottery winners, help cities and towns with their motor fuel tax money, operate the 911 emergency phone centers, some money that went to the Secretary of State's office, which had stopped sending reminders to renew vehicle registrations. It was a compromise.
Which
you don't hear much of these days in Springfield. But is this a sign of anything changing?
Yes and no. Clearly, it was something that should have been done earlier, Rick. And it was unfortunate that it took as long as it did to get something pretty sensible concluded. As you know, there are lots of forces in play, and there is no instance of any one side wanting to give the other the upper hand as we enter into the political season, which never seems to end anymore.
Right.
But it's good that it got done. There have been a couple other small instances of compromise and what I say is instances of sense and sensibility. Are we going to see more next month because there's some reduction in vote tallies that are required? There's some reduction in temperatures, a little bit at least, because of conversations that have occurred. I don't hold out a ton of hope that it's going to happen so soon, but I do think it will happen. I think it has to happen, and everyone agrees on that kind of premise.
Well, I know everybody's talking about come January, and that's, you know, for legislation to take effect immediately requires a 3/5 supermajority of the House and Senate. After January, it's back to a simple majority. So, yes, the numbers come down to pass something. You also have the fact, too, that we have just gone through the filing period for the primary election. So people kind of have an idea of what the political climate is. And people, I think, were anxiously awaiting to see on both sides, you know, how things would line up. Do you think with filing being over, that changes the dynamic?
Not yet, because filing is over, but it's the petition challenge season now. So we're going to see who actually stays on the ballot, who has challenges. There's always some intrigue and interest in that process. But as it looks right now, ironically, Rick, it looks like the Democrats in the House particularly will have the more interesting primary season. Why that's occurring is some people's best guess and speculation. But because the reduction in the vote tally goes from 3/5 majority to a simple majority isn't enough of the calculus to determine if we can get something done, because now 20 Democrats, 4 or 5 Republicans in the House have presumably have primary challenges. They're not folks that are going to be taking a lot of brave votes in the short term, given they have elections coming up in March.
Right. Well, and also, I mean, that has always been kind of what I've seen that is kind of the roadblock to any progress,
right,
is that you still have the general election, too. And if there isn't an opponent on the other side, they can plug one in, you know, if nobody's filed. How do you vote for necessarily raising revenue and making some really tough budget cuts,
right,
with the big election up?
So that's always the question now. And so you can always use an election as an excuse to continue in perpetuity of just standing still and letting the world run us over. I mean, Illinois is a financial train wreck. Anyone that can do basic math can figure that out and understands the resulting difficulties. And they're only compounding. They're only getting worse. So stuck in a quagmire of fear of an election is going to have to be, frankly, tackled from both sides of the aisle. And I think the right recipe for that is occurring. Look, what's happening in Springfield is ugly, and it's not something we should be proud of. But if we weren't having this great debate, if we weren't having this great reckoning, it would just be the ordinary course of raising taxes, continuing to raise spending, and not fixing some of the fundamental problems and flaws this state has. So while I do not hold hope, I'd love to be wrong, that something gets done in January, I do think something gets done before April, and I do think it will be something, it will be a great compromise, and it will take people on both sides of the aisle to shed their fear and start acting responsibly and not fear an election. And in fact, any politician that says, you know, I'm not going to do anything and I'm going to stand still ought to be jettisoned, because it's time for action now.
So you don't see anything till after the March primary?
I don't. I hope I'm wrong, Rick. I often am when it comes to guessing politics, but I don't think so.
That's still, I mean, but we as you say, these problems accelerate the longer we're without a budget, because the backlog of unpaid bills grows, the overspending without the revenue to support it, you know, puts us in the hole even further.
There's no question. If anyone that's interested in finding out the depths of financials, the financial chaos that the state of Illinois is in, they can go to Leslie Munger, the state comptroller's website, which keeps kind of a daily ticker.
Right, the running tab.
Yeah. And it's daunting. You know, she pays bills when money comes in, and of course when there's no money in, the bills accumulate. And I think they're between $6.7 and $7 billion. By the end of this month, some speculate it could be as high as 8 or 8.5. The state does not have the ability to issue currency, and we cannot incur new debt right now because of the impasse. So all we do is just put bills on the side and just not pay them for a while and kind of stick it to our creditors, which is a horrific way of doing business, no doubt about it. At the same time, this is how the state has been transacting business for years.
Right.
For years. And it's fine. It's finally the time to stop it. And I think the great reckoning that I call it in Springfield, that's occurring. And it's not fun. It's ugly. And it's frustrating. It's still a good thing to have, because if we weren't doing this, maybe the bills would be at $4.2 billion, Rick, but we'd still be doing the same thing. It's now finally getting the attention of everyone, and that's going to cause movement. I hope it's next month. It could be April. But in that window, I think movement will occur, and it will be positive.
We're speaking with State Representative Ron Sandak, Republican from Downers Grove. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
Santa baby, just slip a sable under the tree for me. Then an awful good girl, Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight.
The University of Illinois Rip Cords helping us celebrate the holidays here. And I'm with University of Illinois graduate Ron Sandak, state representative, Republican from Downers Grove, here in the Allstate Showcase studio. We're talking about the state budget impasse, which I think we could just have that as a weekly feature here on the Sunday Spin. But, Representative, I wanted to ask you, as a former mayor, one of the issues, of course, is the idea of a property tax freeze. And the governor has made no bones about, we got to do something about property taxes. And, of course, everybody hates property taxes. And to me, it goes back to the whole issue of how it's an archaic form of taxation. But nevertheless, but as part of his call to freeze property taxes and to allow, he wants to allow municipalities, school districts, flexibility when it comes to collective bargaining. And Democrats say that's a poison pill right there. What, as a mayor and as a Republican, you know, is that a must-have?
Well, here, there's a couple of things, and it's a great question. First of all, property taxes is something that makes people's their blood boil. I go door to door. I've talked to people in my area, in the 81st, and taxes are high, Rick. They're really, really high. And when they talk to friends and family in different states, and they have comparable homes or, frankly, homes, less expensive homes, they're paying two, sometimes three times the amount of real estate taxes. And that's aggravating. So a freeze, especially after the economic bust that occurred where values were declining rapidly,
right,
and dollars were still increasing, that was an anathema to people that just said, wait a minute, that doesn't make a lick of sense. The way we have to look at taxes right now in Illinois, and that means all taxes and all revenue, is what I say is we need a reset button. And I think a two-year property tax freeze helps the larger context of a reset, because here's the bottom line. Pensions, state pensions, particularly teachers' pensions, which is what is picked up by the state.
Right.
Speaker Madigan for years has been trying to shift the go-forward cost of all pensions onto the locals. The theory is pretty simple. Look, school districts, you cut your collective bargaining agreements with your teachers. You put on your local taxpayers what it's going to cost, except the state picks up the employer costs all the time and sometimes portions of the employee cost.
Right.
That can't go on anymore. I think he wants to say, here, you want to cut your deals? You pay for your deals. There's logic and reason behind that. The only way that's going to occur, though, is to give a reprieve, if you will, a reset, if you will, so that school boards can figure out if they can cut these deals, what they can pay, how they're going to pay what they're going to pay, or maybe take a step back. So a property tax freeze for taxpayers is badly needed, to your point about collective bargaining. The fact of the matter is flexibility and giving local units of government real control over their province, over what they do, makes enormous sense. In Illinois, you ask any mayor, except for the mayor of Chicago, because they're always carved out, their hands are tied. They're told, do this, that, and the other thing, pay for it yourselves, but it's mandated. So the idea of saying, look, guys, figure out for yourselves what you want to negotiate with your collective bargaining units. Do what you want and pay for it your way and keep the state out of it. It's called mandate relief, and frankly, it lets local government, which is closest to the people, do their own thing, unencumbered by Springfield know-it-alls, which don't know that much.
But I will say, I haven't seen like the Illinois Municipal League, you know, jump on the bandwagon for that.
The Illinois Municipal League may not have jumped on the bandwagon for that issue per se, because they frankly see it. It's two sides to the coin, right? One is you're going to freeze my taxes, and municipalities get, what, 10% of the property tax? But it's 10% they need. And if you get into central and downstate Illinois, it's frankly pretty important because there aren't the same commercial
resources, right?
Sales tax revenues aren't as plentiful in certain areas of the state. So I get that. In the overall context of things, do I think more municipalities think having flexibility and local control is a better thing than not? You bet. Do I think there's a wariness of jumping on board other than to say, leave my local tax, my local distributive tax, and give me my motor fuel tax and my 911 money? That's where they want to be. The fact of the matter is, as a former mayor, would I like more flexibility? Would I like to be able to do what I can do for my constituents free of as much Springfield entanglement as possible? No doubt about it.
But already we're hearing reports of some municipalities, some local school districts, believing that there will be an ultimate property tax freeze, are already trying to jump the rates.
You know, it's funny, Rick. If you're a suburban legislator like I am, they're doing it already. They've been doing it for years. School districts in the suburbs have been taxing to the maximum amount of PTEL, the limit,
right,
on the tax cap, for years, and putting away on the side reserves that are frankly unconscionable. And Governor Rauner spoke to this way back in February. Look, tax equity means taking what you need, not taking what you want in case something bad happens or you presume something may be bad down the line. I get it. Some taxing bodies now are flexing their muscle in anticipation of a freeze. In the suburbs, they've been doing it for years, ever since PTEL came into existence. So I understand that. I wish it weren't being done. Maybe the answer is to go to a tax freeze for 5 years then and really equalize what's going on and give that reset a longer stay of reprieve so that we can all get our collective act together.
In that reset period, as you call it, that 2 years, is that enough time to truly fundamentally change the way we get taxed in the state?
No, it won't. But it gives that reprieve and that kind of cooling down period and that get ready, if you will. But whatever happens going forward will be phased in, Rick. There won't be a light switch that says we're going to reset all our, you know, taxing bodies starting, you know, January 2019. That's inconceivable and completely unworkable. Any type of change in the way we tax, in the way we collect revenue, and where revenue goes will need to be phased in. And even the pension go forward shift, if you will, is contemplated on a 5 to 10 year go phase in period.
Right.
So there will be no, you know, dastardly, okay, now we're changing the rules of engagement at light speed. And as you know, nothing in government is even remotely close to light speed.
That's a great way to sum it up. State Representative Ron Sandak, Republican from Downers Grove, thank you so much for getting up with me this morning on the Sunday Spin.
My pleasure.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on your Sunday Spin, Amanda Lewis, Associate Professor at the University of Illinois Chicago and a member of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. And we'll be talking about her research into the issue of the racial achievement gap in schools.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
312-981-7200 is our phone number. I'm Rick Pearson. This is your Sunday Spin. And getting to be a nice, bright day out there, a little bit of wind. There was reports of spotty fog out there. You could kind of see some moisture on the street outside on Michigan Avenue. But I just was out on the Storm Center patio, and everything seems to be going nicely today. And so get out there and enjoy kind of the December weather. And it's not that bad. And it's supposed to get a lot warmer by the next week. So stay tuned for that. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio at Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue is Amanda Lewis. Amanda's associate professor in the departments of sociology and African American studies at the University of Illinois Chicago, and she's a visiting scholar as part of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. And we're kind of having the Institute Day here on, yes, on the Sunday Spin. We'll have economist Richard Dye will be joining us later in the show. But Amanda, I have to tell you, I'm kind of fascinated by this research that you're doing into the issue of the racial achievement gap in schools. And you've been doing very intense research on,
yes,
this. And but I'd like for you to lay out what we're talking about here.
Absolutely. I'll talk about it in two ways, big and very concrete. So the big picture is if you look at any one of a range of national data on test scores, basically any educational outcome, test scores, GPAs, what you'll see is there's been a consistent gap between white students' outcomes and Black and Latino students' outcomes. And that's, you know, it narrowed a little bit in the late 80s and then got bigger again. But it's one of these things that's been a very stable data point for a long time.
Even with changes in testing, that kind of thing?
Yes. Even so, the most recent data was California had a new test that came out that was supposed to be particularly geared for the new Common Core tests,
right,
Common Core curriculum. And again, same racial achievement gaps they've had for years. The other way that the gaps manifest, and this is something that came up for us, particularly in the district that we ended up studying, is if you go into a building like Riverview, and we can talk more about Riverview in a second, you see that even though diverse schools have a lot of kids moving through the hallways together, Black, white, some Latino in this case, once you get into classrooms, they're not always in the same classes together. And so you can see these numbers, and they can be a kind of upsetting, and you can think about why is that? But when you actually get into a building and see kids almost segregated into different classes, it feels viscerally really disturbing to see, even in 2010, 2015, that we are having this kind of segregation within schools, not even just between them.
No, and Riverview being the unknown school,
yes,
that was part of
the pseudonym for
the research, yeah, that you did. But I want to get into some of the issues of like myth versus, mm-hmm, fact. And
absolutely,
because you have the issues of well, one is and you even referenced Michelle, yeah, Obama talking,
yeah,
about,
yeah,
student shaming, as it were.
Yeah. So when you talk to people about racial achievement gaps, or when they hear about the data, there are two very common sense ideas that people have for what must be going on. And those are deeply attached to kind of long existing kind of racial mythology. So one of them that you just alluded to is the idea that what's going on is that Black and to a certain extent Latino students, people assume, have a kind of oppositional culture to school, that they think of school as being a white thing, as being a kind of white institution, and that they put pressure on each other not to engage. They think that doing well in school is not a cool thing, and therefore
carrying books.
Yeah, exactly.
Is not
so that's
cool.
The quote that you often will,
right,
hear, but either Barack or Michelle Obama say that we need to get rid of the slander that says that a Black teen carrying a book is a white thing. The challenge there is that, you know, that would be slanderous if it were true, but for the most part, and this is not just true of our study, but I could name 15 other books, about 50 other journal articles, that we just don't find that to be the case, that Black teens who are doing well in school are just as popular as their less successful peers, that they this widespread thing about telling kids they're acting white if they're doing well in school is just not actually very widespread. It's just not a good explanation for what's going on. That hasn't, unfortunately, dampened at all the idea that that's what's going
on.
Yeah, people still
think that concept.
Yeah. So every time I talk somewhere about this, people say, well, the first thing you got to do is get those teenagers to stop discouraging
each other.
And the first thing I say is, if you actually hang out with teenagers, mostly they're teasing each other for not doing well. They're not saying, you know, oh, you got an A. Oh, you must be. I mean, that's just not happening. I mean, there is some teasing of nerds or brainiacs, but that's
across
all racial groups.
Right.
Yeah, so teenagers are perfectly capable of being obnoxious in the same way now as they always have been. But it doesn't have any kind of racial valence to it. The other The other myth that is also very pervasive and is pretty widespread now, partly because of some kind of counter ideas going on, so is the idea that Black and Latino families just aren't invested in education in the same way. And I think of this now as kind of the reverse tiger mom problem. So there's been a lot of attention to the idea that Asian American families do particularly well because their families just value education more. And one of my colleagues from UC Irvine just published a book on the Asian American paradox, basically showing that what we have known for a long time, which is that the biggest driver of Asian American overachievement is partly our immigration policies. So in terms of who we admit...
I thought that was fascinating, yes.
Yeah, so we, because we selectively admit the highest educated folks, like if you look at, for instance, you know, the myth about China, the percentage of folks in China who have higher education degrees is very small. It's just that the ones that we admit into the U.S. happens to be, you know, are the same from... So there are lots of ways in which the pattern of our policies shapes outcomes in ways that we don't think about. So we give it a kind of cultural explanation that doesn't actually match very well to what's going on. But the myth that Asian Americans do well because of their culture then reflects back that these other groups must not be doing well because they don't have the right cultural stuff, right?
Right.
And again, you know, whether we look at survey data, when we interview parents, on every measure, this is just not the case. Black and Latinos parents care about education as much as anybody else. They're invested in it. And all the data we look at, especially once we control for class, which is an important factor here, shows that they are doing as much strategizing and they're doing all the work that other middle class and upper middle class
parents
are doing.
They're pushing the kids the way everybody else does.
Exactly.
Okay, those are the myths.
Yeah.
And when we come back, Amanda Lewis, associate professor at the University of Illinois Chicago, we're going to talk about what you found in the research that are the realities for what's behind the racial achievement gap. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
Is there some witch of a ring, all caroling? One seems to hear words of good cheer from everywhere, filling the air. Oh, how they come, raising the sound high at the other town, scaling the ring while people sing songs of good cheer. Christmas is here.
The University of Illinois Ripcords from a couple years ago when my daughter was a member of the preeminent women's a cappella group at the University of Illinois. And always nice to get in that kind of spirit. Joining me is another Amanda Lewis, associate professor at the University of Illinois Chicago and a member of the Institute of the University of Illinois' Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And we're talking about her research into the issue of the racial achievement gap in schools. And your latest research involved Riverview, which is a school that which will never be identified publicly.
Exactly.
But part of using Riverview was an example to find a school that kind of fit the proper research demographics you were looking for.
Yeah, so what we wanted to look at and what Riverview kind of manifests for us is a kind of best case scenario. So when people think about racial achievement gaps, they often imagine a kind of low income, majority minority urban school as compared to like a highly resourced, predominantly white suburban school. So they imagine the kind of extremes.
Right.
And that's not very helpful because when we're trying to figure out, you know, what are the racial dynamics here versus what are the class dynamics, all those things get conflated in that kind of example. And so Riverview is interesting for several reasons. One is it's a highly resourced suburban school that has been desegregated for over four decades. So there is
viewed as a model of segregation.
Yeah, it's also one of these schools that is often on the, you know, top 100 schools on the country list or best place to send your kids to school. The community is cited as, you know, a great place to live. It's a very liberal community. It's a community that's committed to equity and where people move precisely because they value diversity. So for a lot of different reasons, it seems like a place that where racial achievement gaps shouldn't still exist. It's also a place where the African-American population is predominantly middle class and at least solidly working class. It's not a high poverty district. So it allows us to look qualitatively, kind of in depth more, at what are the roles schools play? What's happening inside schools that might be contributing
without
to these
the extraneous kind of weighting
exactly.
factors that could conflate some
exactly.
of the myths even.
Yeah, exactly.
So
yeah.
So what did you find?
Well, you know, one of the things that John and I did, you know, through the interviews and being at the school for multiple years, was trying to identify the kind of subtle everyday dynamics in which race plays out. So for us, it's trying to understand how race functions at multiple levels. So we know that even in a district like Riverview, where the white and black kids are coming predominantly from middle-class families, we know from the data that the white middle-class families still have more resources. So they're not equivalents necessarily. They have more wealth. They even within Riverview, they live in somewhat segregated neighborhoods, so their social networks are deeper. And so you can see some of the consequences of that even in the school in terms of their access to knowledge about which are the best classes to be in, all those sort of things. But the thing that we were surprised about was how much of those things filtered into the school. So the reason we ended up naming the book, Despite the Best Intentions, is because what we saw was all the ways that despite the fact that almost every person we talked to in the school really had good intentions and were disturbed by the racial achievement gaps and saw themselves as trying to intervene in various ways, they themselves were engaged in behaviors that contributed to it. And I'll talk about a couple.
Did they realize that?
Well, you know, it was interesting. They kind of realized it in atomized ways. You know, they might identify one piece of the puzzle. They realized, for instance, that structurally in the school, one of the things that did make things worse was the tracking system, right? So they have in the school, as in most high schools, public high schools in this country, there are high track classes, the honors and AP classes, and then there's the regular classes. And that tracking is where you see what I talked about earlier, this kind of segregation in the school. So the honors and AP classes, what are sort of the privileged educational spaces in the school, are predominantly white. And the regular...
They were the white elite classes.
Yes.
And then the regular track is the minority
yes.
status.
And that's what actually translates into schools. It's not just the honors and regular class. They kind of gain a racial valence to it. So when you talk to people about it, they say, well, there's the honors white track and then there's the minority track. And people in the school recognize that actually contributes to the achievement gap. So they recognize that. So when we talked to principals, they said they were worried a lot. You know, they said, we're supposed to have high expectations in both, but we see higher expectations in the honors classes than we see in the other classes. We see more what they call bell-to-bell teaching in the honors track. So when you go into honors class, the teacher starts teaching as soon as the bell rings and teach basically past when the bell rings, right? And you go into a regular class and there's some settling in for a few minutes and then people sort of get started and it might end a few minutes early. So there are lots of ways, and this is again mirrors what we find in kind of data nationally, that anybody who gets into an honors and AP class does better. They have the best teachers, they have the highest expectations, they have the best resources. And so wherever kids started out, the gaps just grow once they get placed onto these different tracks. And what happened was that white families, white kids reported that they were much more likely to be automatically tracked into the honors and AP classes. And if they weren't, the parents intervened immediately to get their kids placed there. So one of the things we heard from teachers a lot was that there were some kids who didn't really belong in those classes, but the parents would like pay for tutoring and do everything they could to get them in there because the parents knew these were better. They knew the classes, the quality of the classes were better, and if their kids were going to be in the school, that they wanted them in the best educational spaces within the school. The irony being, of course, that they also talked about their kids wanting a diverse experience, and they just weren't having them in these classes. And so what we found over time is that while people were committed to diversity, it was kind of a shallow commitment in some ways. And
there was also the difference in grading, too,
yeah.
that you noted. That,
yeah.
You know, like what is a B.
Right. Absolutely. So there are two ways at play. So if you're in an honors AP classes, the other way, you're not just getting better teachers, you're also getting weighted grades. So if you get an A in an honors or an AP classes, and you know, on that 4-point scale that matters so much for college admissions, it counts more, right? So an A in an honors in a regular class is 4 points. An A in an honors class is 4.5 points, and an A in an AP class is 5 points. And colleges and universities pay attention to that. So when parents were pushing to get their kids in honors and AP, it wasn't just because the best teachers were there. It was also because it matters for college admissions and that sort of thing. And what we know is that those kind of dynamics, those kind of separation of kids have some racial influences to them. So Black kids at the school were often automatically tracked into lower classes. And when their parents tried to intervene, they weren't as successful getting them into honors and AP classes. They were tracked kind of subtly starting in fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. And it meant that, for instance, if you think about math, that if you hadn't taken algebra by the time you got to ninth grade, you just couldn't get to calculus because it's a, you know, a, there's a kind of linear progression right there. And what was interesting about it was, you know, this people thought this kind of mirrored, you know, well, some kids can do this better than other kids. But when teachers intervened and offered geometry in the summer to the kids who were doing well in freshman algebra, the kids who were kind of behind, they ended up doubling and then tripling the number of Black and Latino kids in calculus, and all those kids did well. And so it showed people that there was a kind of sorting going on that wasn't mapping onto people's capacities, but was reflecting something else. And it led to more questions about what does it mean that these kids aren't in those classes even when they can do well in them.
It's fascinating stuff. Yeah. Fascinating research. Amanda Lewis, associate professor at the University of Illinois Chicago and member of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, Richard Dye, Institute of Government and Public Affairs member at the University of Illinois, and we'll talk about smart budgeting practices for a state that doesn't have a budget.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio, and I'm joined for this segment by another member of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, Richard Dye. And Dick Dye has been on the faculty since 1990 and basically looking at specializing research as far as government finances and budgeting practices. And he is a co-author of a report to be released tomorrow as part of the Fiscal Futures Project at the Institute regarding the way Illinois does its budgets and how it should improve to in so many areas. But the first way they could improve, wouldn't it be to have a budget?
Well, obviously. And so, you know, if you can't analyze the budget because we don't have one, then you should I have to find some other use of my time. So,
but that explains everything. Yeah,
so Illinois' budget problems are huge, an underlying structural gap on the order of $4-6 billion, and accumulated deficits from accumulated IOUs from past deficits way in excess of $150 billion, and that's the big problem. That's the huge problem. That's the content of the problem. But contributing to how we got here and very useful in looking at in its own right are the practices.
Which contribute to how we got there.
That have enabled, concealed even, many of the past choices that allowed us to get so long and so deep into this problem. So that's what we took up this year, and that's what we're looking at tomorrow.
Here's out of the report is that in Illinois, we find Illinois has bent or broken virtually every principle when it comes to sound budgeting practices.
So our start into looking at budgetary practices took us back to first principles. What are the things you should look to? What are the touchstones, the desiderata of budget practices? And we grouped them under, we grouped four principles, and then under those four principles, we looked at the practices. Advanced planning. And you know, when I say these things,
they're common sense.
It really is a duh, right? Sustainability, matching, balancing current spending with current revenues.
There is something novel.
Flexibility. It's not always going to be a trend line. You're going to go up and down with revenues and spending obligations. There's going to be shocks and surprises. And transparency. You should report and disclose what you are doing in an understandable and timely way. And if you're violating one of these other principles, there ought to be some sort of a disclosure that alerts people to it. And that's where the concealment has come in the past. That's where the enabling of bad choices
decades. Well, let's talk about that whole issue of transparency. I mean, what kind of practices has Illinois done where it's not being transparent?
Mostly, I would group the bad practices under the sustainability heading, but we didn't see them. For a big example, a huge example, pension funding in Illinois is almost always discussed in terms of how are we meeting the payment from this 1994 law that said. But in 50 years, we're going to get the pensions back to 90% funded. But we don't look at what the Governmental Accounting Standards Board says, that you should be, if you ever get behind, 100% funded in 30 years. So there's a difference between what the state pays with gnashing of teeth and wringing of hands, oh, it's so big, and what would be necessary.
And would he be even bigger?
Right. What would be necessary to not even get further behind? So think of the pension payment as having three elements. The part of the current year contribution that goes with all the current workers gaining one more year of experience, and therefore, if you look forward to their pensions, there's a bigger pension because they have one more year of experience. So that's called normal cost in the lingo. And then second, it's like amortizing a mortgage, there's two elements to paying down the unfunded liabilities, the amount by which you've gotten behind, and that is the interest cost and the payment toward principal. We have not and will not on the current schedule pay anything towards principal, get the liabilities actually going down until 2030. So every year, we get farther behind on pensions. People in the know that, but it's not announced. Here's the budget. And, oh, by the way, if you adhere to that budget, there's an extra billion or two that we're getting behind.
I want to move things a little bit forward in light of our current budget situation. Where, and this is why this is so, I think this is why it's so important, is because we're going to have to raise revenue, we're going to have to cut taxes, or cut spending, rather, and raise revenue. And as you say in the report, no one, policymakers, voters, no one's going to be happy here. And there'll be losers, there'll be some winners. But unless you kind of lay out how you do in a responsible way, people won't necessarily, you know, they won't know how to adequately pick, you know, where we should go as far as determining what should get more money, what should get less money.
Yeah. So full and clear disclosure does two things. First, it tells you how bad things really are. And, you know, I'm Cassandra, I say this, you know, the sky is the Chicken Little, but one of those two personas I have.
Among many, yes.
And others have been doing this for years. But better and clear and more clear reporting would help understanding of how bad things really are. So there's a shared understanding that things are really bad, but what does that mean? And therefore, you'd know how tough the choices really are. And if full and clear disclosure made you reveal how much you're shifting on to future taxpayers by whatever compromise, you know, package that may eventually come out for the fiscal 16 budget. So you know both how bad things are, and you also know the time and winners-losers consequences of different choices that you're considering.
We're speaking to Richard Dye from the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois about how we can get a handle, truly, on how we spend money in this state of Illinois, even as we don't have a budget for the fiscal year of 2016. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
I don't want a lot for Christmas. There is just one thing I need. I don't care about the presents underneath the Christmas tree. I just want you for my own, more than you could ever know. Make my wish come true. Ooh, all I want for Christmas is you.
The University of Illinois Records. A couple of years ago with our little Christmas music here this morning. We're speaking with Richard Dye from the Institute of Government Public Affairs at the University of Illinois and talking about the current budget mess, but also kind of the things that helped contribute to our perpetually being in a budget mess. And one of the things, and you, yeah, I know you kind of acknowledge some of this is duh, but the fact that the way budgeting is done in Illinois, it's near term, it's just for the year. There's no looking ahead at all.
Now, Representative Sandick said that you know there's always an election coming up, and there's always that sort of focus. So, yeah, I got into this back in 07, 08. The particular thing I'm doing now, the Fiscal Futures Project, looking at the Illinois budget objectively and with a longer-term focus, because I saw that lacking. You know, decisions were being made that had...
You're doing what government isn't doing.
Well, I'm doing what government isn't doing. Decisions were being made that had effects in out years, but there was not an accounting for a number assigned to what was happening in those out years. It's always short-term, near-term, short-sighted. And that's an easy characterization of what budgeting has been and is, and one of the more charitable terms we could use. Only recently, only in the depths of the crisis, the cyclical crisis triggered by the the recession and bubble burst back in 08, with revenues falling off sharply in 09 and 010, did we actually require some sort of a forward look, a 3-year look ahead budgeting? That's great. That's a wonderful start. And the people who are doing it on the legislative side and the governor's side are putting out, good and responsible documents asking some of the right questions. They're very limited in their scope, but that's it. That's all we do. And it's sort of separate, and it's here's the report that the legislation says we should do. But we don't look ahead farther than that. We don't. Other states look five years ahead. We don't really project spending. It's all revenues, and spending is just sort of a plug. If we get those revenues, they would have to be cut. But, oh, no, the governor isn't proposing we cut them. That sort of stuff. There's no capital plan. There's this ad hoc every 5-7 years, a political consensus bills that we need stuff built. That's not planning. And note, with capital planning, it's always specific new revenues.
Right.
Another riverboat license, tax on this, tax on that. That's not a way to do business. You know that you have roads and buildings and big things that wear out or need to be replaced. You should plan for that on an ongoing basis. There's a procedure in use in most other states, authorized in Illinois, called fiscal notes, where anybody can ask for an analysis of a bill.
Well, I was going to get into this, because when we don't project the costs of what a law will be.
Right.
There's a you can request when somebody proposes a law. Let's say it cracks down on certain types of criminals, and so that means is there going to be a financial impact to having to build more prison space? That's the purpose of these fiscal notes. But as you note, and as I've often seen, it's not people necessarily wanting to know what's the financial outcome of the laws we pass that request these fiscal notes. It's to try to block the legislation or delay it.
Exactly.
It's a political tool, not a practical financial tool.
We should plan for the future, and those plans should be meaningful and not just become, you know, legislative tactics, as that specific example is.
You noted that too, and I didn't really kind of consider it that way, but I can see how you would do it. The couple of years that the state didn't pay for pensions was in essence another form of borrowing, because we're freeing up money for other purposes here.
Exactly. There's all sorts of other forms of borrowing. The delay in bills payment to vendors, mentioned in an earlier segment. Issuing bonds to pay for 1 year's contribution, which bonds go out 30 or 7 or 10 years, depending on which pension obligation bond series you're talking about. So that's taking sustainability was one of the principles I mentioned. There's two reasons that is a first principle. One is prudence. I know that's an odd word in Illinois, but you should match what you're spending with the sustainable inflow of revenues, not one-time sources, not borrowed sources, not spending assets that previously exist.
Not temporary taxes, as you also know.
Yeah, so not one-time sources like temporary. So that's prudence. It's also, and this is huge, fairness. Sending the bill to future taxpayers is not fair. And there's only one example where it might be, but what's right about the mess that we're currently in? That means taxpayers now and for years going forward are going to have to pay for things that were purchased by the state decades past. That ain't fair. But we do it. It gets us to the next primary. It gets us to the next election. So not ignoring sustainability is both unwise and unfair.
So remember those words when you hear politicians decrying the tactics of kick the can down the road, because that's how we do government in Illinois.
And that's what metaphor I was trying not to use in explaining sustainability, as I did.
Allow me to do that. Yeah. Richard Dye from the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, thank you very much for coming up, waking up with me this morning, coming into the studio, and good luck with your event tomorrow where you lay out some of this in further detail.
Thanks, Rick.
We'll be back with more right after this. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, Ron Sandek, a Republican state representative from Downers Grove, and Amanda Lewis and Richard Dye from the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. And now it's time for the Great Dean Richard Show, and I see Ted Koppel.
How about that?
That's fantastic.
It was cool. Got to spend some time with him this week talking about the news business, his perspective on what it's become.
I'd love to hear that. I can't wait to hear that.
Pretty interesting, but he's got an amazing new book on the threat that the power grid in America is under right now.
Maybe cyber threats?
Cyber threats that really could take down America in a single swoop. It's
more good news.
Good morning, everybody. Good Sunday morning, everybody.